with gratitude, with appreciation, and with a deep sense of responsibility and a hope that we can reduce the number of lives lost and we can begin to build trust and heal. I'm honored now to sign this legislation, and I'm gratified.
Governor Gavin Newsom today is signing new use of force legislation for law enforcement. Most notably, the law changes the language governing the circumstances under which officers are allowed to use deadly force. Now they can do so only when it's necessary rather than when it's merely reasonable. Jeremy White covers California politics for Politico. He's with us now. Welcome, Jeremy.
Good to be here.
So in a tweet, you called this bill one of the nation's toughest police use of force standards. Why? Explain what this bill does.
Well, as you said, this elevates California's standard for when it's permissible for a police officer to use lethal force, from when it's reasonable to when it's necessary. So this goes from a situation in which you could say officer was acting reasonably and out of fear that they were in danger, which is a somewhat subjective standard, to the much tougher standard of it being necessary to prevent harm or death. Now, there's still some wiggle room in there.
Yeah.
An earlier version of the bill had a stricter definition of what counts as necessary. That part was taken out, so it will now be more up to the courts to adjudicate this on a case-by-case basis. But I think it's fair to say that this is still a enormous deal for California, and I think sort of for our national debate over policing and use of force.
And we'll get into some of the changes between the original bill and what it's become. What does this mean for prosecutors first, though, when deciding to bring charges against an officer following a use of force incident?
Well, this changes the standard that prosecutors can consider when deciding whether to bring those charges. It broadens the universe of sort of the behavior by officers leading up to a use of force that they can consider. It did end up removing a provision that would have allowed peace officers to be held criminally liable for criminal negligence, which results in use of force. So, there was definitely some give and take with this bill. But certainly it creates more potential penalties for a peace officer to misuse deadly force.
In practice, what is this ideally going to look like? Are we going to see officers being retrained based on this new bill? Will there be new de-escalation tactics out there in the field? What can we expect to see?
Yes, I think both the law enforcement groups who tried to negotiate for a version of this bill they could live with and the supporters of the bill itself, the legislators who pushed this bill over the finish line, will tell you that this bill was not intended as a sort of punitive gotcha measure. It's not intended to see more peace officers charged. It's intended to shift the way the police officers are trained and the way they approach these situations. So initially, the bill, law enforcement sort of backed a rival bill that would have focused on training around implicit bias and de-escalation without actually changing the standard. They ended up negotiating around this bill that does change the standard. And the hope is that with that sort of real concrete teeth to the bill, that police departments, sheriff's departments will become a lot more stringent in how they train their officers and really emphasize not using lethal force unless it is, as the law says, completely necessary.
So there has been, you've mentioned several times, there was a compromise that got us here. Law enforcement actually initially opposed this bill, but then they reversed course and they backed it. You've gone through a few of these changes. What else changed in the bill and why?
I think that we've sort of gone through the most significant ones there. Really, the key moment with this, with these negotiations were law enforcement had going from sort of focusing on training and not wanting to touch the actual standard to getting to a point where they were willing to entertain dealing with the standard itself. And I think that is a remarkable change. Even in a state known to be as liberal as California, law enforcement groups still have a lot of clout in politics. Lawmakers don't want to defy their local police chiefs or sheriffs. And I think the fact that law enforcement ended up getting on board with a bill that does change the standard demonstrates that they felt they had to do something. And I think that's a real shift.
Do you really think that this will lead to major changes, or is it just that the bar is so low around the country? Because obviously this bill has had some of the teeth taken out of it.
You know, I think it's a little too early to tell. There is evidence from other places like Seattle that have adopted a tougher standard geared towards necessity rather than reasonableness, that it does reduce that use of force, those situations in which force is used. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see with the implementation of this law. But I think there is certainly more reason for hope now that there will be some, you know, as we said, some real teeth behind this to try and shift the way policing works in California.
So we're watching Governor Newsom sort of create in real time his kind of criminal justice history. Put this in the context of the other decisions that he's made, because his record so far is kind of a mix of progressive and perhaps not so progressive. On one hand, he had this moratorium on the death penalty. On the other hand, he prevented the release of prisoners who were eligible for parole. Where does this leave us?
Well, you know, any governor is going to make some decisions about which prisoners can or can't be released on parole. I don't think that's something that's unique to Gavin Newsom. But, you know, he, as you mentioned, he made the decision to impose a moratorium on the death penalty, which not that long ago in California politics would have been an incredibly risky political move. I think it's a little less so now. So I think the governor has certainly demonstrated that he wants to sort of continue California's shift away from some of the sort of incarceration-focused, tough-on-crime policies of the past. And I think it bears mentioning that he came into office at a time when a lot of this work was already underway under Jerry Brown. A lot of it from both the legislature and voters voting to reduce sentences for drug crimes and theft, from felonies to misdemeanors, to loosen parole rules, obviously to legalize cannabis, the legislature voting to do away with cash bail. There's been a lot of criminal justice reforms coming out of the electorate and the legislature even before Newsom took over. And he certainly has said in the campaign and has sort of demonstrated so far that he wants to continue that process.
All right. Jeremy White covers California politics for Politico. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, LA Times reporter Thomas Kerwin followed several of LA's homeless as a new program aimed to move them off the streets and into homes. He's here to tell us about it next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano, in for Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court is not well, and the people know it. That statement comes from a legal brief a small group of Democratic senators filed in an upcoming New York State gun control case. Their memo has ignited a firestorm, particularly because of the line that follows. It reads, quote, "Perhaps the court can heal itself before the public demands it be restructured in order to reduce the influence of politics," unquote. The Democrats say they're merely giving the court a reality check when it comes to how the public sees the court. But others, particularly conservatives, see the memo as tantamount to a threat. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal. Hello.
Hello.
So what is the threat that conservatives feel is being communicated in this brief? What is the, quote, restructuring? How is that taken to mean in this context?
Well, it's meaning essentially packing the court. So it's meaning what a lot of the presidential candidates have talked about, which is, are there other ways to structure the Supreme Court? Like, should we have term limits? Should we have more people who sit on the Supreme Court? This has been something that, frankly, the candidates have talked about more than in past election cycles. And it is kind of a threat in the sense of you might feel really comfortable with your lifetime appointment and your 9 seats, but we might want to change all that. So maybe you should be circumspect about your decision on this gun control issue.
You meaning the current sitting judges?
Exactly.
Don't these lawmakers have a point, though, on these very highly contentious political issues? We have increasingly seen the court split along ideological lines.
We've increasingly seen the court split along ideological lines up and down for decades now. So I would say that I think Democrats are playing a very dangerous game here. And I'm not entirely sure that their audience actually is the Supreme Court so much as it might be the voters. So I think with the voters, this brief is going to be very popular. And we know that there is great support for increased gun control. We know that there's more support among the voters than there is among our elected officials who are meant to represent us. But what's not at all clear to me is whether they think this brief will really cause a quote unquote change or awakening when it comes to the members who are actually sitting on the Supreme Court now, in large part because we know that they were appointed through a very political process. They were appointed by a president who was a member of either party, obviously, then confirmed by the Senate. And those elections and appointments have consequences. So I don't think that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is going to be sitting on the Supreme Court thinking, gosh, I really was going to have one vote, but now the Democratic lawmakers really have scared the bejesus out of me, and I don't want anyone to not like me, so I guess I'm going to change my vote.
And it does seem like kind of an idle threat anyway, right? Like, take us through the process that would be required to make these potential changes.
Well, I think what they're actually trying to do is something a little more nuanced than we're going to restructure the Supreme Court immediately, even though that's what they're explicitly saying. I think what they're saying is actually directed more towards Chief Justice John Roberts in this case. And what they're trying to say is, we know you care about the integrity of the institution. We know you're a so-called institutionalist, and people are going to start thinking that the emperor has no robes, that you are just politicians with black robes on. And so why should we trust you? And do you want to be the Supreme Court justice who presides over the essentially eroding of any trust left in one institution of government?
And do you think that would have an impact on him specifically, basically, that you think about your historical legacy?
I think that idea of think about your historical legacy is incredibly important to Chief Justice John Roberts. Does this brief swing that in any way? I don't think so. It is so aggressive and potentially inflammatory. I don't really think that he is going to feel pressure as a result of it. In fact, it could go the other way, where people don't want to look like they were compliant with a threat from politicians.
And we may be remiss, I should possibly ask you to tell us, what about the underlying case that this brief is about? Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so there's an underlying case where essentially New York City implemented very strict gun control laws, which I'll describe briefly as incredibly stringent in terms of where you could travel with a gun. And it was so stringent that it was actually upheld by a trial court, upheld by a court of appeals, but then New York City decided to repeal that law, and New York State decided, yes, you should repeal that law, and we're going to make a law that you can never implement that law again, because I think they were worried about what happened in a case about a decade ago, where there was a very strict local law. It was upheld in the lower courts, went up to the Supreme Court, and that's the decision called Heller, where there's a lot of pressure by gun control advocates saying, drop this law, do what New York City actually did, which is repeal it. They didn't. And now we have Supreme Court language that says there's an individual right to bear arms. New York did not want to take that path. So they're trying to say, Supreme Court, don't take the case. It's so-called moot. There's no case or controversy here.
All right. So we'll keep an eye on that. One last thing I want to turn to, another story in the news. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is based here in California, of course, handed the Trump administration kind of a partial win in its push for an asylum ban. This is the Trump policy that prevents someone from applying for asylum in the U.S. if they pass through another country and didn't seek protection there first. So what did the court say?
So this is a very partial victory. What the Ninth Circuit said is, we're going to uphold the lower court, the trial court, that said we don't think that this is a legal prohibition. We don't think, Trump administration, you can do this. But the partial win is that they essentially narrowed what the trial court said so that the rule can only not take effect in the Ninth Circuit. There was, the trial court said, this rule can't take effect anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. But there was a competing federal judge who said, no, maybe it can. And so what the Ninth Circuit said is, okay, just for our jurisdiction, just for the states that are covered in the Ninth Circuit, the rule cannot go into effect. This is a big issue that has come up again and again in the Trump administration, where we've seen federal judges implement these nationwide injunctions. And there's going to be a reckoning as to whether or not those are appropriate.
So does this, let's talk about the specifics of what this then allows. So does that mean if a migrant from Honduras shows up at the border in Texas or New Mexico and they didn't apply for asylum in Mexico or Guatemala, are they just going to be sent back?
Yes. So it means that we have a patchwork of immigration laws right now, which is exactly what a nationwide injunction is designed to guard against, which is if you are in one state, the federal law means something. If you're in another state, the federal law means something else. And there will, look, this is in some ways, I think, destined for the Supreme Court in the sense that we have a split among what behavior is acceptable in different geographic locations. The Supreme Court may have to be the arbiter of what's appropriate.
Jessica Levinson, she is a law professor at Loyola Law School. She joins us every Monday. Thank you very much for making it clear for us.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority estimates nearly 59,000 people live on the streets of LA County. And the county and city are spending more than $1 billion trying to do something about it. One landmark pilot program in South LA set out to move an entire encampment off the streets and into two brand new apartment buildings. This is around 70 men and women. LA Times reporter Thomas Kerwin spent more than a year following some of these residents as they transitioned from the streets into housing, and his remarkable four-part series about it is called The Street Within. In it, Kerwin shows solving the homeless crisis isn't as easy as giving people four walls and a roof, and he joins me now. Hello, Thomas.
Hey, Rico. How are you?
I am fine. So this program you wrote about is called Encampment to Home.
That's right.
Tell us about this program and why this specific South LA homeless encampment was chosen to move into supportive housing.
Well, in early 2018, a number of city and county agencies got together and looked at the crisis that was unfolding around them in Los Angeles, and they decided that they needed to try to expedite and work a little bit more efficiently towards getting people off the street. Encampment to Home identified two particular neighborhoods, one in Leimert Park and the other in the sort of South Broadway, Martin Luther King Boulevard neighborhoods. We picked the one in the Broadway Place, Broadway neighborhood, and met with Big Mama and a couple of her neighbors who'd been living on the street for a number of years there.
Some of your characters, yeah, that you follow throughout.
Exactly right.
Why focus on moving an entire encampment? Because I know previously the idea would be that groups like this would go and try to find the people that were most in need of getting off the streets. In this case, they didn't bother. It's just if you were in this encampment, you were all going to get a home.
Lock, stock, and barrel. Instead of identifying individuals, they decided to highlight particular encampments. These particular neighborhoods were very impacted by encampments and the homeless that were living there on the sidewalks. In this particular neighborhood, the Broadway Place, a lot of the businesses there were seeing a lot of tent fires up against the sides of their buildings, a lot of problems on the sidewalks. Leimert Park is in the midst of a bit of a gentrification going on there. Right. And so they felt that these were two good neighborhoods to be focusing on. The highlight of this feature was the fact that they had two apartment buildings about 5 miles away down the 110 freeway that were going to be available in the end of June. That they could be able to identify these candidates for those apartments, and they were able to sort of turn the model on its head. So instead of finding individuals and getting them all cleared and then trying to find housing, in this instance, they had housing, approximately 160 units or so, and then they were going to find these encampments and try to move these people pretty fast. 4 months was the initial sort of timetable to get them off the street and into these units.
You mentioned earlier Big Mama, some of the other people that you tracked through the story. Tell us about Big Mama.
Oh, Big Mama was a delight. She was really our guide to the street. When we first started exploring this particular neighborhood and meeting some of the residents, they all said, you really have to talk to Big Mama. She's been here the longest. She had a tent that was around Martin Luther King and Broadway Place, the closest to that intersection. And she has been on the street for 9 years in that location. She originally came here from Texas around 2000 or so, and found herself on the street pretty much for that duration of time and various aspects of her life as she tried to find gain some footing here in Los Angeles when she first arrived.
And when she showed up, she did not have a job even, you know, in mind. She had no money in her pockets when she showed up. But I was surprised, and maybe naively so, to find out that some of the people in this encampment were actually gainfully employed, including one woman, I believe, is it Helen? Wendy.
Wendy.
Who is a vocational nurse.
Yeah, it's real interesting. What this story and what the series of stories highlighted for me is that homelessness is not a monoculture, that we often think of homeless as perhaps the people downtown living in these really high congested encampments, suffering from mental illness. This was a pretty interestingly middle-class encampment. The people there were very functioning, and indeed, Horace was very proud of the employment that he had, first at Goodwill and then at Big Lots as a security guard, and Wendy as a hospice nurse.
But then what explains their homelessness? Why are they living on the streets?
They can't get enough money to muster up the rent that they needed to live.
I guess it's just that simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
You note in one of your stories that every person in this encampment that you were profiling is African American, and that African Americans make up a very disproportionate share of people who are homeless in LA compared to their share of the population. Does the city have any explanation for why that is?
The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority did a study earlier this year in which they looked at the racial disparity on the streets. Indeed, African Americans are highly overrepresented on the street compared to their general numbers in the population. And the conclusions were systemic racism.
That would indicate a bias specifically against blacks, not even against Latinos, who obviously are a large part of the population as well. It's specifically against...
Well, if you were looking at the numbers this particular year, the latest homeless count, I believe, put Latinos at just an edge above African Americans on the streets. The year before, African Americans were at the top of that percentage. It is a question of just, as I say, discrimination that's faced these individuals, these groups that have put them out in the street and made housing difficult for them.
Tell us then about the moving process. What went into getting this group of people into this new apartment complex you told us about?
It's a fascinating story. One of the aspects of this story that we originally intended to report upon was just how difficult it is to get people off the street. I mean, how hard can it be, you might ask yourself. And we discovered it's very difficult. The number of forms and clearances and vetting that goes on with these individuals, the appointments that they make, either it's with a housing authority or whether it's with the service agencies, the interviews that are conducted to just make sure that their credit, their background, their police checks are all in line with what people need. It's quite a fascinating and quite a laborious process, more paperwork and forms than I could dare want to do myself.
And a fascinating wrinkle to me about this was apparently this housing is provided by a mix of county and federal agencies. And the federal housing rules seem to have more strings attached. Can you describe this?
Yeah, in this particular instance, I think you're referring to is the fact that when these residents moved into these apartments, they were given a number of rules to abide by, which stands to reason when you're moving into an apartment complex, the landlord has certain guidelines for you. In this particular case, they were told that no drugs, particularly no marijuana, would be allowed on the premises. And so I was wondering, how could that be with marijuana now legal in the state and with most of these people, if not all of them, having medical dispensary cards? And it turns out that because the building is taking federal funds, they're not allowed to use marijuana on the premise.
And in addition to that, one of the other rules is that they're not allowed to bring friends in or have anybody stay with them longer than 14 days.
14 days, exactly right.
It seemed like between this and the marijuana rules, some of these rules seemed to be designed to set some of these residents up to fail, because obviously you come from the streets. A lot of your friends are still living on the streets. So there's going to be a pull to bring these people in and stay with you.
Yeah, a set to fail might be a little too harsh. I mean, one of the challenges that's faced, and this is what we discovered in the reporting, is The counselors and the therapists that are working with these individuals in their new apartments, providing what's called supportive housing, are working very hard to help these individuals break the habits that they had on the street. In order to survive on the street, you need a large group of people around you. You're accustomed to the comings and goings of lots of people. Mm. And when you move into apartments, those habits and behaviors aren't quite compatible with living in a tighter community, as you said earlier, between four walls, a ceiling, and a floor.
But given that, I mean, how hard is it to break those habits? There's a, tell us the story of Nisi, who I think is one of the best examples of this.
Nisi just was not able to break those habits. She talked about how without a lot of visitors around her and guests and friends spending time in her apartment, she'd get scared. This is a woman that has had a very difficult life, as with all of them. A lot of trauma follows these people from the streets into these apartments. And in Nisi's case, having friends and acquaintances around her helped sort of distract her from perhaps the, her own internal demons.
But she had a boyfriend from her past shows up basically with a machete, and she ends up getting kicked out of the building.
In the best that I could understand this particular scenario is that it was sort of the last straw in terms of property management's dealings with Nisi. I think she'd received a number of warnings, and she'd seen this continue problem that eventually started jeopardizing not only her and also the other residents and also the staff at, in the building itself.
But there were some success stories. What exactly is the success rate? Of these 70 people, how many of them are still in housing?
Well, there were 68 people that were moved, and so far as I can remember at this point, there were perhaps four or so that fell out. So they're doing pretty well. They're doing pretty well, I'd have to say. And the successes are really remarkable.
Give us an example.
Well, I spoke with Big Mama last night, and she's just thrilled. I mean, she's so grateful to be off the street and so eager to share her story and to get out there and talk about homelessness and what it means now to be in housing.
We should also probably note, though, this did not come at zero cost. For 70 people, moving them into housing, what was the total cost?
Yeah, it was approximately $850,000 that came from Measure H that voters passed 2 years or so ago. This is a measure that was devoted towards social services, outreach, and in this case, certain things like logistics and administrative costs requiring moving these people off the street.
No small amount of money, and yet your story ends by saying another encampment has sprung up in basically the same place where the Broadway encampment was to begin with. Clearly, it feels like you're always going to be playing catch-up as you address symptoms rather than maybe the underlying disease. What is the underlying disease, and how do we address it?
That is the big, big question that I think was the eye-opener for this particular series. I think a lot of people think that housing is the end of homelessness, but homelessness is the causes of homelessness lie in a lot of trauma and a lot of long-range trauma that's taken place in these people's lives that needs to be addressed as soon as you get them into housing and even when they're on the street.
Thomas Corwin, thanks so much for your reporting and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, the 80s might not have been a great time for progressive politics, but it was a golden age for progressive music.
Historically, if you look back, Ronald Reagan is the president that gets cited the most in protest music as an individual president, just because he came up in the heyday of American punk music.
A brief history of protest songs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano, filling in for Madeline Brand. For today's Monday music segment, we are talking about protest songs. 50 years ago last weekend, you may have heard, hordes of music fans gathered in Bethel, New York to hear bands like Country Joe and the Fish play songs that spoke to the politics of the time.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
And today, the music sounds a little different, but in some ways, it seems like not much has changed.
Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em.
This month, Childish Gambino set the record for the largest crowd ever at San Francisco's Outside Lands Festival, singing politically charged anthems like This Is America. But are protest songs as ubiquitous as they used to be, as influential? And who's writing them now? Joining me to talk about protest anthems past and present is KCRW music guru Eric J. Lawrence. Great to see you, Eric.
Hi, Rico.
Very nice to have you. So before we dive in, should we define our terms, maybe? To you, I ask, is a protest anthem a song that by definition has to be heard by and taken up by a lot of people, like a national anthem? Is it still an anthem if it just galvanizes a small group of people? Or if an anthem falls in a forest and there is almost no one there to hear it, is it still an anthem?
Anthem is probably the difficult word there, because anthem does suggest it needs to be taken up by a majority of the populace in some capacity. However, to be a workable protest song, all it need do is galvanize enough people, activate enough people on whatever the topic is, and there's a variety of topics to address,
yep.
that if that motivates them to do something above and beyond just simply listening to the song, then I think it's a successful anthem that way.
But really, so do you think a protest anthem actually has to galvanize someone into action? Has it ever really been the song that inspires action, or is it more the soundtrack to action, or created by the people taking action, maybe?
In some cases, it may just be a matter of even just thinking about a subject mm-hmm. that you've not sort of thought about from a particular dynamic before. And if that then sort of motivates you to think about, oh, I see this is now really a serious problem, how can I address it as an individual?
Raising awareness maybe could be
correct.
The action.
Yeah, that, I guess that, I think that's fair.
All right, with that in mind, take me back. What do you think of as like the prototypical American protest song?
Well, I mean, you know, in American history, American musical history, Woody Guthrie is sort of reigns supreme in terms of that type of sound. His music has lasted the test of time, and you know, his song titles, I mean, if you consider the song This Land Is Your Land,
sure,
is so iconic as a phrase that you can imagine those songs being very powerful at the time of their creation.
What about that song? We were talking about prototypical song, right? Mm-hmm. What about it is therefore in it that is forms the blueprint for what follows?
Well, it is a song that expresses a very personal opinion. It's not just simply a storytelling song, right? That's what a lot of songs that we think of, especially when we think of kind of singer-songwriters, they're kind of telling a story, and it might be, you know, from a first-person perspective, but this is something that's meant to be an address to the public at large. And, you know, I guess I wouldn't say that that song has much anger behind it, but there's conviction mm-hmm. in spades. Mm-hmm. That is a song that, you know, he leaves no rock unturned in terms of trying to understand what his position is. It's
sure.
very clear. And as an American, that is something that I think has been an important part of our history, is that we have these sort of patriotic heroes that are defending the American way.
Let's jump forward to the 60s. Which I think is remembered as the era protest music was almost synonymous with popular music. What's the song that for you takes that prototypical formula from Woody Guthrie and then adds something new to it?
A good example of a song from that period is Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction.
Oh, wow.
Now, one reason to say that is that was actually the first protest song to reach number one on the pop charts back when it was released in 1965.
Really?
But it was also a anti-war, certainly, but also anti-nuclear kind of a song. This idea that this buildup of nuclear arms was going to lead to, literally, the Eve of Destruction.
You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has
bodies floating, but you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
A lot of people forget that, you know, we had a number of other wars before before the Vietnam War that engendered a fair amount of music to come out of it as well. In fact, Bob Dylan, who we often, you know, sort of see as a paragon of protest singing, in many cases, most of his songs weren't specific to the Vietnam War.
Nope.
They were sort of more just general anti-war songs. So that was a case where this is a very time-specific moment with the Eve of Destruction to be sort of representing something that was a threat to us all in that moment and that, you know, brought that concern to the younger generations.
I also, the thing that definitely comes to my mind that really changes the sound of the protest song, even though it still has a lot of the same, I think, attitudes, is Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
Correct, yeah.
Which I guess you could also argue is a prototypical hip-hop song. What do you think about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. Now that, you know, in many cases, the two biggest motivating topics of protest around the 60s were the war, in that case specifically the Vietnam War, but also the civil rights era created just a motherload of music to come out of it with the civil rights movement. And there's, you know, innumerable participants from people like Aretha Franklin and Nina Simone and
for sure.
Otis Redding, many others. But that song in particular brought it very much to the streets, this idea that, you know, a street poet essentially is what Gil Scott-Heron was, bringing sort of his vision of what he saw on a daily basis and how that applied to the lack of attention within the political sphere.
Yeah, not probably the first inner city protest song, but certainly one of the best known. Let's listen to it. This is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial.
One other interesting thing about him as well, on I think it was on the same album that that track appeared from, he had another song called Whitey on the Moon.
Yep.
And it in particular strikes me in this 50th anniversary of the moon landing, where, you know, he was complaining that, you know, the media coverage of the moon landing was, you know, omnipresent at the time. And yet, you know, these people are dying in the streets of the ghetto and whatnot.
We're not paying attention to anything happening on Earth, but we're putting Whitey on the moon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Skipping all the way ahead to the 21st century, I think we first have to talk about whether it's even possible for protest songs to regularly get the attention of people the way they did in the 60s, just because of how we get our music, right?
Yeah, I think it's both a matter of how we get our music and also the way the music is produced. I'm a believer that one of the biggest transitions that have occurred over the past 30 years or so is a transition between the individual as a singer-songwriter, composer, to the idea of the producer being the one creating the music. And so the producer's responsibility is to come up with a hook, come up with a interesting sound bed, and then, you know, give it to an artist to sort of give their personality on top of it. Well, that's not sort of the way historically most of these protest songs were generated. And so as a result, I don't think we have nearly as much of a personal attachment, this issue of conviction that occurs with the frequency that it used to occur in the history of pop music.
That's a good point, but let us not say that it doesn't ever happen, because it certainly does.
It does.
And the first thing that came to my mind when I was thinking about this in the present day anyway was Janelle Monáe's The Hell Are You Talking About. Let's listen to this. It's a really powerful piece of music. Just this anthemic but still desperate kind of list of people of color who have been killed either in police altercations or racist incidents. Super powerful. And the thing that really is amazing to me about it is that Janelle Monáe and their collaborators also released an instrumental version of this specifically so that other people could take the instrumental and put their own names over it. Pretty remarkable. What do you make of it?
I mean, that's, yeah, that's clearly an example of what does happen in the 21st century and being able to attach to a particular area of protest. And obviously the whole sort of Black Lives Matter is one of the premier topics of discussion in culture and in music as well. Beyonce has a number of songs that are relevant to that. Kendrick Lamar, obviously somebody that's very tied into sort of similar types of concerns and issues. And that does all stem from early hip hop days as well. That was a topic of discussion for many of the early hip hop artists, you know, some of it quite explicit in sort of NWA with, you know, their F the Police kind of idea. But even, you know, one of the first kind of breakthrough hip hop songs, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Fives, The Message, was, you know, following in the lead of Gil Scott-Heron. And so, yes, that is a through line that continues to today's music makers. And if there is a particular through line, it comes from the hip hop community that are still making that kind of music.
I do want to also say that I think something really interesting is that back in the George W. Bush presidency, I remember there was this kind of latency period where there was this obvious huge political divisiveness that was growing during his presidency. And it took a long time, it felt like, for mainstream musicians anyway to start actually protesting it. With the Trump presidency, I feel like it started dropping before he was even sworn in. There was a band called Anal Trump. Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have. Yes.
This is Rob Crow of the band Pinback. And it's basically 100 songs, each of them like a second long. He put and crammed onto like a 45 or something. He put it almost the day of the inauguration or something.
And punk is interesting because punk has been sort of one of those genres that has always been politically motivated. And I think historically, if you look back, Ronald Reagan is the president that gets cited the most in protest music as an individual president, just because he came up in the heyday of American punk music and Dead Kennedys and the Minutemen and bands like that. Presidents always are a very clear target. Trump is an interesting case. One of my favorite recent records, this is actually a case of just very recent, it just came out this summer, from a band called School of Language, released a record called 45. And it is basically entirely about Donald Trump, 45th president. Many of the songs are just so biting in terms of talking about his behavior and the different people that he's had in his administration and how, you know, there's a song about Rex Tillerson and about, you know, his quote about him being a moron and all of this kind of thing. So there are there can be very specific targets. And presidents are those, and you know, historically it has been the Republican presidents that are the ones that are sort of cited for the highest amount of vitriol.
Can we play that album, a song from that 45 album on the air without being bleeped?
Absolutely. There's a song called Adult in the Room, which is an interesting song from that record.
All right, let's go out with that. This song does not necessarily represent the views of KCRW or its employees. And thank you so much, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you.
Except for Steve Chiatakis, the song absolutely represents his point of view.
No. Steve. The disclosure handles me as well.
Okay, Steve.
Please.
Steve Chiatakis, you're here to talk about what's coming up today on your show, Greater LA.
Why are you throwing me under the bus, Rico Galeano?
Because it's fun. We're live and you can't do anything about it.
You know, on a more serious note, we're going to talk more about the folks. You remember the Woolsey fire that blew through, charred thousands, tens of thousands of acres through Ventura, LA County, lots of Malibu, as a matter of fact. People rich and poor in that part of town were affected, and now they're having trouble getting insurance going forward because Malibu, of course, has burned before, and those insurance premiums are going sky high, so we'll talk about it coming up.
All right, that's on Greater LA. Coming up on our show, climate change is about to hit your wine glass as Napa Valley braces itself for a new kind of weather by planting a new kind of grape. We'll tell you about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Rico Galliano. We've all heard about the catastrophic effects of climate change, rising sea levels, melting glaciers, endangered species. Let me add another crisis to that list. No more California Cabernet Sauvignon. Winemakers in Napa Valley are increasingly anxious about the future of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes, which grapes make Napa Valley's most popular wine, of course. Some Napa winemakers are taking matters into their own hands, planting experimental vineyards with grapes that thrive in warm climates. Here to tell us more is Esther Mobley. She covers California wine for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hello, Esther.
Hi there.
So, first of all, let us talk about what's being lost. Cabernet Sauvignon grapes, why have they traditionally thrived up there in Napa, and what has changed?
Well, Cabernet is not going away entirely from Napa anytime soon.
Oh, thank God.
We should all be grateful for that.
Yes.
Cabernet Sauvignon, of course, is the grape that Napa has made its fame on. It's also the main red grape of Bordeaux, and it's a grape that in the world of fine wine grapes can take a lot of heat. You can grow it in relatively warm climates, as opposed to some grapes like Pinot Noir that really demand a cooler climate. But temperatures are rising in Napa Valley and in Bordeaux and in wine regions around the world. And there will theoretically come a point where Napa's climate is too hot for Cabernet Sauvignon. The wine industry has kind of some standardized sense of temperature bands in which certain grape varieties can grow in. And a number of Napa wineries basically believe that their vineyards are going to move into a climate band that will be too hot for Cabernet by the 2030s.
So we've got about 10 years left for California Cabernet?
Yeah, well, of course, Napa's one part of the state, and it's not so clear-cut. There's all kinds of ways in which people are trying to figure out how to mitigate the effects of heat, from things like putting shade cloths over their vineyards to actually experimenting with different rootstocks that might be more drought-tolerant. The main problem is that, of course, Napa Valley Cabernet costs a lot of money. The average bottle of Napa Valley Cabernet now costs about $70 because it's one of the best wines in the world, according to a lot of people. So as temperatures rise, the quality of Napa Valley Cabernet is almost certainly going to be compromised. It might still grow there, but it might not make a great wine.
All right. So then moving on to the solution, tell us about these kind of experimental vineyards and the types of grapes that they will grow, I guess, to sort of replace or help offset the lessening excellence of California Cabernet.
Right. So a few wineries, and really just a few, this is kind of the beginnings of what may ultimately become a larger movement, and it's really being done on the individual level, not yet on the industry-wide level. But I wrote about Larkmead Vineyards in Calistoga, Spotswood Winery in St. Helena, and Beckstoffer Vineyards, which owns vineyards all around the North Coast, which are planting vineyards with grape varieties that are known to do well in really hot climates. In Europe, especially along the Mediterranean. So a grape like Torriga Nacional, which thrives in the heat of Portugal, Tempranillo, which is the famous red grape of Rioja in Spain, Alicante Boucher, another red grape from Portugal, Aglianico, a red grape from warm climates in Italy. So they're trying to see, could these grapes do better in a hotter Napa Valley in the future? And it's not necessarily that you're suddenly going to see a bunch of Napa Valley Torriga Nacional, but could Napa Valley Cabernet, as it kind of becomes compromised by heat and drought and who knows what else, be blended maybe with some of these grapes to maintain the style of wine you're used to getting from Napa Valley Cabernet today.
So is the idea then that you would blend these with the Cabernet and still create something that's more or less like a Cabernet, or will we see them change into more of the types of wines you just mentioned?
That's the big question. Larkmead Vineyards really thinks the former. They think they're going to really be able to maintain a similar, they hope to be able to. They haven't, you know, this is like years away from actually seeing what are these wines going to taste like, because they're just now planting the vines. Spotswood Winery says, hey, we want to still make Cabernet, but we don't think that's going to be Napa Valley. They're actually, they said they're looking to buy land in cooler areas, and they may be growing Suzhou and Alicante Boucher at their St. Helena winery. And this is a winery that currently makes 200 plus dollar bottles of Cabernet. I mean, some of the greatest Cabernet in the world. So it's really a dramatic shift to be making and a huge financial investment.
Yeah, I was going to say, how expensive is that investment?
It's really hard to say because involved in that calculation is the opportunity cost of not growing Cabernet, which can command so much money. So anyone who has land in Napa Valley and isn't actively growing Cabernet Sauvignon in it is taking a huge loss. But Larkmead, just to build on what they're going to need in the winery to make these experimental wines, so we're just talking like add-ons to the cellar space, they said is $75,000. So that's just the beginning of it and doesn't even begin to account for the rest of the costs.
Is this a Hail Mary? Are they fairly sure these grapes will grow and that they'll produce a decent product?
They're pretty, yes, they're sure they will grow, and these are expert winemakers. They know how to make great wine out of them. I think what's the big question is there's something ineffable about great wine and great Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. There's just something about it that makes it makes people around the world want to pay all that extra money for it. That I mean, I taste a lot of it, and I can just tell you there's something really special about it. So the question is, can Napa, which depends so heavily on the greatness of its wine, continue to make really great wine, not just serviceable wine, not just sound wine, but truly world-class great wine.
All right. Esther Mobley, she covers California wine for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you.
And joining us as well right now is our good friend Michelle Eloy.
Hello.
Hey, giving us some feedback from around the world of the interwebs. What's going on out there real quick?
Yeah, we just wanted to know what people's favorite protest songs were. We have Max Fresco says FTD by YG and Nip. I cannot say what that stands for on air. William Vasquez says Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Personal favorite, too.
Of course. And don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Rico Galliano. It's been a pleasure sitting in for Madeline Brand. We'll see you soon.